As one of America's largest financial services companies, Nationwide supports financial professionals with client-friendly resources and innovative solutions to help create greater retirement security for their clients. Nationwide Investment Services Corporation, member FINRA, Columbus, Ohio.
Take your business further with the smart and flexible American Express Business Gold Card. It's packed with benefits to help unlock more value from your business purchases. That's the powerful backing of American Express. Learn more at americanexpress.com/businessgoldcard.
Welcome to the Bloomberg P&L Podcast. I'm Pim Fox, along with my co-host, Lisa Abramowitz.
Each day, we bring you the most important, noteworthy, and useful interviews for you and your money, whether you're at the grocery store or the trading floor.
Find the Bloomberg P&L Podcast on Apple Podcasts, SoundCloud, and Bloomberg.com.
The Trump administration aims to have a replacement for retiring Supreme Court Justice Anthony Kennedy confirmed in time to join the court for its new term in October. This, according to the White House today. Joining us now to talk about this, Noah Feldman, professor of law at Harvard University, also a Bloomberg Opinion columnist, also a former clerk to U.S. Supreme Court Justice David Souter. Noah, thank you so much for being with us. I just want to start with your view of kind of how we're going to proceed going forward, who you think the front runner will be for this Supreme Court vacancy.
Well, the Trump administration has publicized a list of potential nominees, and rumors have that list cut down to further to five people. And until now, the administration has been as good as its word in nominating people from its public lists. So based on prior experience, it's almost certain to be one of those five. What they have in common is that they're all dyed-in-the-wool conservatives. In age, they range from middle 40s to late 50s. And most, though not all, have some experience on the federal appeals court.
So, dyed-in-the-wool conservative can take different forms when you're talking about constitutional law, whether they're originalists, whether they're more sort of ideological. What's your impression of these particular candidates?
I think nearly all of these, perhaps 100% of them, would, if asked, say that their constitutional philosophy is broadly originalist. I don't think any would say that they had some other view, and none would say that they supported the idea of a living constitution.
Noah Feldman, based on what you know in terms of the court's current voting pattern, and based on what you've just described in terms of the kind of person, their legal perspective that will join the court, what kinds of rulings do you expect when the court reconvenes in October?
Well, the biggest issue, which will be watched most closely and debated most intensely over the next few months, is certainly abortion rights. Several states have either passed or on the verge of passing laws that are extremely restrictive of abortion rights, much beyond the current legal standard. And those are the ones that we'll be focused on. And for that reason, I think one of the crucial issues over the next few months in the public debate about this is whether several of the more moderate Republicans in the Senate, including Senators Collins and Murkowski, both of whom are formally pro-choice rather than pro-life, would cast their votes to confirm a nominee who would be very likely to vote to overrule Roe v. Wade. And so, you know, that is very much at issue here. It could well be that this justice would provide the decisive fifth vote. We don't know absolutely for sure because we don't know how Chief Justice Roberts would vote, but we know that Justice Kennedy, who's just retired, cast the decisive vote to preserve Roe v. Wade back in 1992, and we know that whoever is likely to be confirmed, assuming a confirmation, is probably someone who will think that that case should be overruled.
Well, Noah, is it likely that whoever is the nominee will answer a direct question on this topic?
I'd say it's totally unlikely, close to zero. I mean, in theory, of course, you know, with a guarantee that all Republicans would vote to confirm, the person could actually go up there and do what almost no nominee in modern history has done, namely be honest and say, yes, I would vote on that, and this is how I would vote. But there's a strong precedent now for nominees saying, I can't answer that because that issue may come before the court, and I don't want to disqualify myself in the future, and so therefore I decline to answer. And so my guess is that not just a guess, that my overwhelming prediction is we won't hear any direct answers to that question.
So, Noah, the shift here, Anthony Kennedy's retirement has been portrayed pretty dramatically on both sides, both as a political boon to the GOP and as a sort of, catastrophe on the left. And I'm just wondering, it's definitely pretty broadly people agree this is the biggest change or shift potentially in American jurisprudence since Roe versus Wade. Would you agree, first of all, with that statement? And how do you think it's going to change the nature of Supreme Court rulings going forward?
Yes, it's going to mean a very significant and potentially vast shift. We should keep in mind that part of that is because the Republican Senate blocked Barack Obama's nominee, Merrick Garland, who would have replaced Justice Scalia. If Garland had gone through and then Kennedy had retired, we would be back in a position of balance between the sides. But because the Senate blocked Garland, and as a result, Donald Trump was able to nominate and confirm Neil Gorsuch, that makes this the decisive vote. And the thing is, Justice Kennedy was a conservative in many ways, but on a handful of hot-button issues, including gay rights and abortion and Guantanamo, he actually voted with the liberals. And for that reason, his retirement opens the possibility of a durable conservative majority for a whole generation. And that is potentially a sea change in the U.S. Constitution as interpreted.
Are there any precedents that are being broken or created because of the unusual circumstance of President Donald Trump and the Mueller investigation simultaneous to this potential appointment?
Well, we don't know yet. Certainly, Donald Trump's goal and his success, in fact, has been in breaking all the unwritten rules. And even when he's pressed the boundaries of the written rules, he's more or less gotten away with it. The travel ban was struck down by the lower courts in its first two forms, but as you know, in its final version 3.0, it was upheld by the Supreme Court just earlier this week. It's hard to remember that it was so recently, but it was just earlier this week before Justice Kennedy's retirement was announced. So yeah, there's a kind of pressure on the boundaries of constitutional law right now. And we can expect that pressure to continue because Donald Trump is obviously inclined to try to push the envelope, and a court dominated by conservatives and with two of his nominees on it would probably be much more likely to uphold those actions than would another court.
So, Noah, there has been a lot of focus on abortion rights and Roe versus Wade and possibly that getting overturned. But aside from sort of the hot button issues, is there another place that people should be focusing where we could see a major shift that would have an impact in people's life in terms of how the Constitution is interpreted?
Yes. One question is whether the right to gay marriage, which the court established, would be preserved or overturned. We don't know the answer to that. Another area of importance is environmental law, where if there were to be a Democratic president in the future and a Democratic-controlled EPA, aggressive pro-environmental restrictions could potentially be struck down by a court. Yet another area is the freedom of speech, where a conservative activist court could use the freedom of speech as a tool to strike down relatively progressive laws, which we actually already saw happening over the last week or 10 days in several important Supreme Court opinions. So yeah, there are a whole host of areas in which there could be a real difference. And I would say most broadly, again, should a Democrat get elected president and should there be a Democratic House and Senate in the future, major progressive legislation, again, hypothetically, if it would be passed along the lines of Obamacare, would stand a good probability of being struck down by a conservative court.
Thank you very much. Noah Feldman, Harvard Law Professor, Bloomberg Opinion Columnist. Steel, aluminum, whiskey, mustard, toilet paper, washing machines, motorboats, even maple syrup. These are all subject to tariffs from Canada as it celebrates its 151st birthday on Sunday. And here to tell us about tariffs, trade wars in the United States and Canada is Clay Lowry. He is Managing Director of Rock Creek Global Advisors. They're based in Washington, D.C. And he is also a former Assistant Secretary for International Affairs at the U.S. Treasury Department. And he also chaired the Committee on Foreign Investment in the United States, known as CFIUS. Clay Lowry, thank you very much for being with us. You know, when Prime Minister Justin Trudeau celebrates Canada's birthday, he's going to be doing it under this cloud of trade wars with the United States. What effects do you think this is going to have on the long-lasting relationship between the United States and Canada? And what do you think the economic fallout is going to be?
Well, first of all, thanks for having me. In terms of the our relationship with Canada, it's based on, one, a mutual respect that we've had for a long time between our two countries. So I worry, obviously, that the trade war aspect that you mentioned could affect specific businesses. But I'm hopeful that while there has been some pretty not so great rhetoric between our two leaders of our country over the last few months, that cooler heads will prevail and we'll be able to start coming to agreement on how we want our relationship to go forward. So I have a lot of respect for Canada. Obviously, I respect my own country. And so I think I'm hopeful that that will work out in the end. As to the specific economic issues, I think it's much more going to be a microeconomic story, which is a problem because, of course, it's going to hit specific businesses. You mentioned a bunch of different industries at the lead into this story, and they're being hit. They're not just being hit by Canada. They're being they're getting tariffs by a lot of other countries around the world, and there's a lot of businesses that export and. It's not exactly surprising that the countries are hitting back when we're putting tariffs on them for fairly dubious reasons.
You know, Clay, I'm so glad you're with us today because you have the deep experience with some of these trade relationships that will actually give us an informed view of fairness. You know, we hear a lot about how the U.S. has an unfair trading partnership with the rest of the world. Where do you see the biggest inequities, and are we moving closer to solving those?
So I'm not. Look, I think that having an unfair trading relationship, I'm not sure we actually have that. I know that that is the president's contention, and there's other people that believe very strongly in what he says, and I give them due credit for that. But the I think what we should be always striving to do is to try to better ourselves by making, you know, opening up markets, making sure we have good rules of the road so that we can figure out how do we get our products into other countries, and by the way, allow their products to get into our country, because that actually helps our consumer, and it helps our exporters. So I think that what I would be doing, and I'm not, is I'd be focusing on how to work with those countries in a way to actually get better and more positive, as opposed to what we're right now doing, which is much more negative, which is we're putting tariffs on a number of countries around the world. We did it on steel and aluminum. We're threatening to do it on auto imports. And the one country that really has been probably most problematic has been China. And instead of actually trying to take a coordinated approach with a lot of our allies who have some of the same similar problems with China, we're instead hitting those same allies. That part of the negotiating tactics I don't get, but I'm not the president and I'm not his negotiators.
Clay Lowry, while we're having these war of trade words, I guess, because nothing is set in stone, at least not in the moment, China seems to be moving just as rapidly ahead with its trade ties, let's say, with Latin America. Indeed, I believe if you go to Panama right now, at the sort of promontory right at the opening of the newly widened Panama Canal, in which the first ship was a Chinese ship to go through it. The Chinese have secured land to build their new embassy. Is that going to be emblematic of what happens in the future if this trade war continues?
It's not exactly surprising. I mean, if your country is being hit by the United States on certain exports, why would you not instead try to find new sources of exports yourself, export markets yourself? For instance, I remember talking to a Canadian company, which basically was saying, boy, these steel tariffs are really going to hit us hard because we import from the United States and we won't be able to do that anymore. Instead, what we're going to do is try to find other sources. And it turns out there are a lot of other steel producers in the world.
Yeah.
And so they're now going to be, instead of buying U.S. steel, which was easy because, of course, there weren't really tariffs and it's right next door. Now that there's a 25% tariff on that, they were like, well, we can pay for the shipping costs to come from other parts of the world instead. And
right.
So what you were saying about Panama is not surprising, that people are looking elsewhere than just the United States. We're still the biggest player out there, but we're not the only player.
So just about a minute left here. I'm just wondering, you advise clients on the trade backdrop. What do you tell them?
Well, the main thing is, look, it's been a very bumpy ride, and I think trade clients are very concerned about uncertainty, and the uncertainty is hurting their business. So in some respects, a lot of the tariffs have not actually gone into place yet, but the threat of tariffs has happened, and that is actually already affecting their business. So now with the tariffs in place, it'll affect that more directly. And the only thing we can say is, right now, it's hard to see the plan that is in place from the administration. So continue to prepare for alternatives as the administration thinks through its plans. But basically, there is very little consistency. So because of that, you have to kind of prepare for inconsistency.
Clay Lowry, thank you so much for being with us. Clay Lowry is Managing Director of Rock Creek Global Advisors in Washington, D.C. His resume is very full of government experience with trade, both with chairing the Committee on Foreign Investment in the United States, known as CFIUS, as well as serving as the Assistant Secretary for International Affairs at the U.S. Treasury Department from 2005 to 2009.
Inflation, market volatility, economic insecurity. Who isn't looking for greater retirement security these days? As one of America's largest financial services companies, Nationwide helps millions of people invest in their financial futures. With client-friendly resources and innovative solutions, Nationwide supports financial professionals so they can help clients feel more confident in their retirement years. Nationwide is on your side. Nationwide Investment Services Corporation, member FINRA, Columbus, Ohio.
I want to turn our attention now to video games and bring in Felix Gillette. He's a writer for Bloomberg Businessweek, and he wrote a story that caught my attention. First of all, it was a cover story for Bloomberg Businessweek, and it has to do with Nintendo. And I got to say, Felix, first of all, thank you very much for coming in.
My pleasure.
I did not know that the company was 130 years old.
Yeah.
And I really found that it was fascinating that you managed to go to the Nintendo headquarters. Maybe just describe what you experienced when you went there, and then we'll talk about Super Mario and video games.
Yeah, I had the opportunity to go to Kyoto and interview top executives and game makers at Nintendo. They don't do this very often. I mean, the whole setup is basically, if you're a Western reporter and you say, hey, I want to write about the company, say, oh, great, go talk to the head of Nintendo of Americas. If you're in the U.S. or if you're in Europe, they'll say, oh, go to our executives in Europe. And they don't do too much individual press. So it was a great experience. I will say, in the 15 years I've been a journalist, this story took longer to set up the interviews than any other story I've ever worked on.
So, but describe.
Yeah, so I got there, and it was not what I expected. I mean, it's this, essentially, you go to the headquarters and the R&D building, which is these two buildings a couple blocks away. They're these white minimalist cubes, and they're so perfectly quiet and, you know, just there's no Mario stuff anywhere. There's no Pokemon
no Donkey
stuff.
Kong?
There's just nothing. It's just, the you know, it's very, you know, quiet, serene environment from which all of these crazy, this huge fountain of games has been flowing now for, you know, 130 years.
One thing that I thought was so interesting, full disclosure, as a mother of two boys, mm-hmm. I think of video games as sort of mindless yep. and a place where you go and mm-hmm. sort of lose yourself with a little sort of redeeming value. I'm totally exploring my bias now publicly. But the feeling of whimsy and, mm-hmm. and creativity yeah. and just sort of rooted in history that you really captured here.
Yeah. I mean, it's got, Nintendo has this incredibly rich game making culture. And the company was there at the start of this, you know, this whole art form of video game making in the late 1970s. And their first, you know, very talented game maker, Shigeru Miyamoto, who made Donkey Kong, which was their first globally hugely successful game, he's still at the company. He hasn't left. And he just mentors, you know, generation after generation of these game makers that come in. And in some ways, it's very reminiscent of the entire artisanal culture for which Kyoto is known. I mean, you can go around Kyoto and you can go visit these studios and see these classical crafts of, you know, bamboo making, whatever it is, that go back centuries. And it's a similar system. There's a master craftsman and there's always an apprentice learning. And it's very much this system, this tension between, you know, learning the traditional craft, but also pushing it forward. And the same thing happens in Nintendo, basically. And when you talk to the senior game makers in Nintendo, they all say they always defer the praise down to the newcomers. They say, no, you know, this wouldn't be possible. Yeah, you know, we've been part of these franchises, Mario, Zelda, that have been around for 30 years now, but it really wouldn't be possible if we didn't have these young game makers coming in and pushing these traditions forward with each new console.
Tell us about one of these. Tell us about Switch.
So Switch is the console that Nintendo came out with last year. It's been very successful. It's a hybrid system. You can hook it up to your TV, and then you can also take it with you out, you know, on the subway or the airplane or whatever. And it's been hugely successful. And Nintendo is this kind of fascinating company where it goes through these big boom and bust cycles. And before the Switch came out, you know, they'd been in one of these lulls where people were saying, ah, these guys are, you know, they're like BlackBerry, they're like Sega, they're doomed, they can't keep up with, you know, the mobile phone era, they're never going to have another hit product. And lo and behold, the Switch comes out and gamers go crazy for it. And it's been the biggest thing in video game industry for the past year and a half. And now, you know, Nintendo is kind of back on top. The revenue more than doubled during this past fiscal year. They had this incredible lineup of very popular games. Yeah. Again, these reimagined versions of these franchises that have now been going for 30 years. I played as a kid in the 1980s. Yeah. Their new versions now that kids are playing.
Felix Gillette, thank you so much for being with us. It's a really terrific story, and I'd love to hear more about your trip, frankly. Felix Gillette, writer for Bloomberg Businessweek, joining us here in our 1130 studios. We talked a lot about Amazon and its foray into the pharmaceutical business. A lot of the shares of possible competitors sold off. Today, interestingly, the sell-off is continuing, at least with respect to CVS and Express Scripts. Joining us now to talk about the consequences of Amazon in just lowering drug prices is Michael Ray, pharmacist, founder, and chief executive officer of RX Savings Solutions. Michael, thank you so much for being back with us. I just want to get your view from the outset, when you heard that Amazon was getting into this industry with its latest purchase, did you think that this would materially lower drug prices in the near term?
Well, I think that it will. And I think that the way, the angle that they've decided to take into the market is going to make that a swift, more swift you know, opportunity to do something in the near term. Buying a group like PillPack that really is centered around convenience and logistics with pharmacy licenses in place allows them to make a big move quickly.
Why do you think that someone else didn't scoop up PillPack previously?
Well, I know there was rumor that that Walmart was kind of in the hunt. You know, why they didn't, I don't know if it came down to price or what the deal structure looked like, but it's a tremendous asset for anybody that's looking to, you know, materially affect the pharmacy game, especially as it relates to being, you know, home delivery and convenience for seniors.
Yeah, we actually, Bloomberg News did report that Walmart actually stole it away, or got it stolen away from it, the pill pack purchase, when Amazon came along and outbid them. I just do want to get your sense, Michael, about exactly how Amazon will lower prices materially given this purchase.
Well, I think that, you know, the famous Jeff Bezos quote of "your margin is my opportunity" really rings true here. Amazon is a tremendously big company. They don't enter markets that are small or with the intent of doing things in business as usual. There's also this, you know, strong belief that there's a tremendous amount of excess waste in the supply chain when it comes to pharmacy. So I believe that is what they will attack. You know, Amazon has such a strong brand with consumers. You know, the ability to capitalize on the brand that they've already built and add drugs to that allows them to just, you know, service more and more people.
Yeah.
And do so in a way that's convenient and easy.
Can you just give us a sense of what that excess is in the pharmaceutical industry?
Well, if you look at the supply chain, you've got, you know, your manufacturers, your wholesalers, your pharmacy benefit managers, and your retailers. Each of those, depending on the drug, you know, there's profit built into each of those transactions as the drugs move. How much is enough is a question that's often asked. I think, you know, like I said, Amazon will come in and attack those high margin areas and do so in a way that could, you know, really affect the pharmacy landscape in a short amount of time.
Michael, what role do you think Alexa and Whole Foods will be playing in this?
You know, I don't think Whole Foods, I don't think they're looking to create another retail network. I think that they're trying to build on what their core strengths are, and that's logistics and moving products and making it easy for consumers. As far as Alexa, I think, you know, voice is definitely something, you know, we've worked a lot on at our company and have that function in our app. It's something that people like to use, and as those technologies get better, doctors will use them, consumers will use them much more than they do today. I think we'll look back in 5 years and say Alexa or similar products have really taken a huge or really added convenience to the process.
Michael, I'm curious what you think Amazon's next step will be in terms of its foray into the healthcare industry.
Well, I can only speculate.
Yeah, but you can speculate from an educated place, knowing exactly how much information and access you have once you get into the drug supply chain.
Yeah, I mean, I would guess that they'll start out with you know, some of the easier components of managing drug benefits. I think that, you know, cash generics have been floated around in the market as something that, you know, would be the kind of easy first step. I think that makes sense. But, you know, they're a sophisticated, very smart organization. I think they could attack it in a variety of ways. But this retail piece, interfacing with the consumer, is a good first step.
Michael, if you happen to be running a pharmacy right now, what do you take away from this week's announcement and what should you do? Give you about 30 seconds.
Yeah, I think there's going to be tremendous margin compression on profits. How quickly that happens is to be seen. But, you know, I think as we've seen, CVS and Walgreens are both down 10% in the market. And that, I think that's indicative. And if I was running my own, you know, kind of independent pharmacy, I'd feel the same pressure that those guys are experiencing in the public market.
Thanks very much for being with us. Michael Ray is a pharmacist. He's also the founder and the chief executive of RX Savings Solutions, talking about drug prices, pharmacies, and the effects of Amazon.com. purchasing PillPack. We'll have to see what happens to the brick and mortar pharmacies as a result of this acquisition as well.
Thanks for listening to the Bloomberg P&L Podcast.
You can subscribe and listen to interviews at Apple Podcasts, SoundCloud, or whatever podcast platform you prefer. I'm Pim Fox. I'm on Twitter at Pim Fox.
I'm on Twitter at Lisa Abramowitz 1. Before the podcast, you can always catch us worldwide on Bloomberg Radio.
Take your business further with the smart and flexible American Express Business Gold Card. It offers flexible spending capacity that adapts to your business. You can also earn up to $395 in annual statement credits on eligible purchases at select business merchants. That's the powerful backing of American Express. Terms apply. Learn more at americanexpress.com/businessgoldcard.
Attention campers, the new Camp Snoopy at Kings Island brings your family summer camp fun all season long. Head to Camp Snoopy with Charlie Brown and the whole Peanuts gang for fun and adventure. Race forwards and backwards on the new family boomerang coaster, Snoopy Soapbox Racers. Explore on your own with more space to roam at Beagle Scout Acres. And don't forget to grab a snack at Pigpen's Mess Hall. It's a new way to play with the Peanuts gang at Camp Snoopy. Now open, only at Kings Island, for the fun of it.